Chapter 1 of Ecce Homo by Friedrich Nietzsche. How one becomes what one is. Why I am so wise. 1. The happiness of my existence, its unique character perhaps, consists in its faithfulness. To speak in a riddle, as my own father, I am already dead. As my own mother, I still live and grow old. This double origin, taken as it were from the highest and lowest rungs of the ladder of life, at once a decadent and a beginning. This, if anything, explains that neutrality, that freedom from partisanship in regard to the general problem of existence, which perhaps distinguishes me. To the first indications of ascending or of descending life, my nostrils are more sensitive than those of any man that has yet lived. In this domain I am a master to my backbone. I know both sides, for I am both sides. My father died in his 36th year. He was delicate, lovable, and morbid. Like one who is preordained to pay simply a flying visit, a gracious reminder of life rather than life itself. In the same year that his life declined, mine also declined. In my 36th year, I reached the lowest point of my vitality. I still lived, but my eyes could distinguish nothing that lay 3 paces away from me. At that time, it was the year 1879. I resigned my professorship at Bale, lived through the summer like a shadow in St. Moritz, and spent the following winter, the most sunless of my life, like a shadow in Naumburg. This was my lowest ebb. During this period I wrote The Wanderer and His Shadow. Without a doubt, I was conversant with shadows then. The winter that followed, my first winter in Genoa, brought forth that sweetness and spirituality which is almost inseparable from extreme poverty of blood and muscle, in the shape of the dawn of day. The perfect lucidity and cheerfulness, the intellectual exuberance even, that this work reflects, coincides, in my case, not only with the most profound physiological weakness, but also with an excess of suffering. In the midst of the agony of a headache which lasted 3 days, accompanied by violent nausea, I was possessed of most singular dialectical clearness, and in absolutely cold blood, I then thought out things for which, in my more healthy moments, I am not enough of a climber. Not sufficiently subtle, not sufficiently cold. My readers, perhaps, know to what extent I consider dialectic a symptom of decadence. As, for instance, in the most famous of all cases, the case of Socrates, all the morbid disturbances of the intellect, even the semi-stupor which accompanies fever, have, and to this day, remained completely unknown to me. And from my first information concerning their nature and frequency, I was obliged to have recourse to the learned works which have been compiled on the subject. My circulation is slow. No one has ever been able to detect fever in me. A doctor who treated me for some time as a nerve patient finally declared, "No, there is nothing wrong with your nerves. It is simply I who am nervous." It has been absolutely impossible to ascertain any local degeneration in me, nor any organic stomach trouble. However much I may have suffered from profound weakness of the gastric system as the result of general exhaustion, even my eye trouble, which sometimes approached so parlously near to blindness, was only an effect and not a cause. For whenever my general vital condition improved, my power of vision also increased. Having admitted all this, do I need to say that I am experienced in questions of decadence? I know them inside and out. Even that filigree art of prehension and comprehension in general, that feeling for delicate shades of difference, that psychology of seeing through brick walls, and whatever else I may be able to do, was first learnt then, and is the specific gift of that period during which everything in me was subtilized. Observation itself, together with all the organs of observation. To look upon healthier concepts and values from the standpoint of the sick, and conversely, to look down upon the secret work of the instincts of decadence from the standpoint of him who is laden and self-reliant with the richness of life. This has been my longest exercise, my principal experience. If in anything at all, it was in this that I became a master. Today my hand knows the trick. I now have the knack of reversing perspectives. The first reason, perhaps, why a transvaluation of all values has been possible to me alone. 2. 4. Apart from the fact that I am a decadent, I am also the reverse of such a creature. Among other things, my proof of this is that I always instinctively select the proper remedy when my spiritual or bodily health is low. Whereas the decadent, as such, invariably chooses those remedies which are bad for him. As a whole, I was sound, but in certain details, I was a decadent. That energy with which I sentenced myself to absolute solitude and to a severance from all those conditions in life to which I had grown accustomed, my discipline of myself and my refusal to allow myself to be pampered, to be tended hand and foot, and to be doctored, all this betrays the absolute certainty of my instincts respecting what, at the time, was most needful to me. I placed myself in my own hands. I restored myself to health. The first condition of success in such an undertaking, as every physiologist will admit, is that at bottom a man should be sound. An intrinsically morbid nature cannot become healthy. On the other hand, to an intrinsically sound nature, illness may even constitute a powerful stimulus to life, to a surplus of life. It is in this light that I now regard the long period of illness that I endured. It seemed as if I had discovered life afresh, my own self included. I tasted all good things, and even trifles, in a way in which it was not easy for others to taste them. Out of my will to health and to life, I made my philosophy. For this should be thoroughly understood. It was during those years in which my vitality reached its lowest point that I ceased from being a pessimist. The instinct of self-recovery forbade my holding to a philosophy of poverty and desperation. Now, by what signs are nature's lucky strokes recognized among men? They are recognized by the fact that any such lucky stroke gladdens our senses, that he is carved from one integral block, which is hard, sweet, and fragrant as well. He enjoys that only which is good for him. His pleasure, his desire, ceases when the limits of that which is good for him are overstepped. He divines remedies for injuries. He knows how to turn serious accidents to his own advantage. That which does not kill him makes him stronger. He instinctively gathers his material from all he sees, hears, and experiences. He is a selective principle. He rejects much. He is always in his own company, whether his intercourse be with books, with men, or with natural scenery. He honours the things he chooses, the things he acknowledges, the things he trusts. He reacts slowly to all kinds of stimuli, with that tardiness which long caution and deliberate pride have bred in him. He tests the approaching stimulus. He would not dream of meeting it halfway. He believes neither in ill luck nor guilt. He can digest himself and others. He knows how to forget. He is strong enough to make everything turn to his own advantage. Lo then, I am the very reverse of a decadent, for he whom I have just described is none other than myself. 3. This double thread of experiences, this means of access to two worlds that seem so far asunder, finds in every detail its counterpart in my own nature. I am my own complement. I have a second sight, as well as a first. And perhaps I also have a third sight. By the very nature of my origin, I was allowed an outlook beyond all merely local, merely national, and limited horizons. It required no effort on my part to be a good European. On the other hand, I am perhaps more German than modern Germans, mere imperial Germans, can hope to be. I, the last anti-political German. Be this as it may, my ancestors were Polish noblemen. It is owing to them that I have so much race instinct in my blood. Who knows, perhaps even the liberum vito. Translator's footnote. The right which every Polish deputy, whether a great or an inferior nobleman, possessed of forbidding the passing of any measure by the Diet, was called in Poland the liberum vito, in Polish, nai pozwalam, and brought all legislation to a standstill. End translator's note. When I think of the number of times in my travels that I have been accosted as a Pole, even by Poles themselves, and how seldom I have been taken for a German, it seems to me as if I belonged to those only who have a sprinkling of German in them. But my mother, Franziska Ochler, is at any rate something very German, as is also my paternal grandmother, Ermuth Kraus. The latter spent the whole of her youth in good old Weimar, not without coming into contact with Goethe's circle. Her brother, Kraus, the professor of theology in Königsberg, was called to the post of general superintendent at Weimar after Herder's death. It is not unlikely that her mother, my great-grandmother, is mentioned in young Goethe's diary under the name of Mirthgen. She married twice, and her second husband was Superintendent Nietzsche of Ellenberg. In 1813, the year of the Great War, when Napoleon with his general staff entered Ellenberg on the 10th of October, she gave birth to a son. As a daughter of Saxony, she was a great admirer of Napoleon, and maybe I am so still. My father, born in 1813, died in 1849. Previous to taking over the pastorship of the parish of Rocken, not far from Lützen, he lived for some years at the castle of Altenburg, where he had charge of the education of the four princesses. His pupils are the Queen of Hanover, the Grand Duchess Constantine, the Grand Duchess of Oldenburg, and the Princess Theresa of Saxe-Altenburg. He was full of royal respect for the Prussian king, Frederick William IV, from whom he obtained his living at Rocken. The events of 1848 saddened him extremely. As I was born on the 15th of October, the birthday of the king above mentioned, I naturally received the Hohenzollern names of Friedrich William. There was, at all events, one advantage in the choice of this day. My birthday throughout the whole of my childhood was a day of public rejoicing. I regard it as a great privilege to have had such a father. It even seems to me that this embraces all that I can claim in the matter of privileges. Life. The great yea to life. Accept it. What I owe to him, above all, is this, that I do not need any special intention, but merely a little patience, in order involuntarily to enter a world of higher and more delicate things. There I am at home. There alone does my inmost passion become free. The fact that I have had to pay for this privilege almost with my life certainly does not make it a bad bargain. In order to understand even a little of my Zarathustra, perhaps a man must be situated and constituted very much as I am myself, with one foot beyond the realm of the living. 4. I have never understood the art of arousing ill feeling against myself. This is also something for which I have to thank my incomparable father, even when it seemed to him highly desirable to do so. However unchristian it may seem, I do not even bear any ill feeling towards myself. Turn my life about as you may, you will find but seldom, perhaps indeed only once, any trace of someone's having shown me ill will. You might perhaps discover, however, too many traces of goodwill. My experiences, even with those on whom every other man has burnt his fingers, speak without exception in their favour. I tame every bear. I can even make clowns behave decently. During the 7 years in which I taught Greek to the sixth form of the college in Bala, I never had occasion to administer a punishment. The laziest youths were diligent in my class. The unexpected has always found me equal to it. I must be unprepared in order to keep my self-command. Whatever the instrument was, even if it were as out of tune as the instrument man can possibly be, it was only when I was ill that I could not succeed in making it express something that was worth hearing. And how often have I not been told by the instruments themselves that they have never heard their voices express such beautiful things? This was said to me most delightfully, perhaps, by that young fellow, Heinrich von Stein, who died at such an unpardonably early age, and who, after having considerately asked leave to do so, once appeared in Sils Maria for a 3 days' sojourn, telling everybody there that it was not for the Engadine that he had come. This excellent person, who with all the impetuous simplicity of a young Prussian nobleman had waded deep into the swamp of Wagnerism, and into that of Döringism into the bargain. Translator's footnote. Eugène Döring is a philosopher and political economist whose general doctrine might be characterized as a sort of abstract materialism with an optimistic colouring. End translator's note. Seemed almost transformed during these 3 days by a hurricane of freedom, like one who has been suddenly raised to his full height and given wings. Again and again I said to him that this was all owing to the splendid air. Everybody felt the same. One could not stand 6,000 feet above Bayreuth for nothing, but he would not believe me. Be this as it may, if I had been the victim of many a small or even great offence, it was not will, and least of all ill will, that actuated the offenders, but rather, as I have already suggested, it was goodwill the cause of no small amount of mischief in my life about which I had to complain. My experience gave me a right to feel suspicious in regard to all so-called unselfish instincts, in regard to the whole of neighbourly love, which is ever ready and waiting with deeds or with advice. To me, it seems that these instincts are a sign of weakness, that they are an example of the inability to withstand a stimulus. It is only among decadents that this pity is called a virtue. What I reproach the pitiful with is that they are too ready to forget shame, reverence, and the delicacy of feeling which knows how to keep at a distance. They do not remember that this gushing pity stinks of the mob, and that it is next of kin to bad manners, that pitiful hands may be thrust with results fatally destructive into a great destiny, into a lonely and wounded retirement, and into the privileges with which great guilt endows one. The overcoming of pity I reckon among the noble virtues. In The Temptation of Zarathustra, I have imagined a case in which a great cry of distress reaches his ears, in which pity swoops down upon him like a last sin, and would make him break faith with himself. To remain one's own master in such circumstances, to keep the sublimity of one's mission pure in such cases, pure from the many ignoble and more short-sighted impulses which come into play in so-called unselfish actions. This is the rub, the last test, perhaps, which a Zarathustra has to undergo, the actual proof of his power. 5. In yet another respect, I am no more than my father over again, and, as it were, the continuation of his life after an all too early death. Like every man who has ever been able to meet his equal, and unto whom the concept retaliation is just as incomprehensible as the notion of equal rights, I have forbidden myself the use of any sort of measure of security or protection, and also, of course, of defence and justification. In all cases in which I have been made the victim either of trifling or even very great foolishness, my form of retaliation consists in this. As soon as possible, I set a piece of cleverness at the heels of an act of stupidity. By this means, perhaps, it may still be possible to overtake it. To speak in a parable, I dispatch a pot of jam in order to get rid of a bitter experience. Let anybody give me offence, I shall retaliate. He can be quite sure of that. Before long, I discover an opportunity of expressing my thanks to the offender, among other things even for the offence, or of asking him for something, which can be more courteous even than giving. It also seems to me that the rudest word, the rudest letter, is more good-natured, more straightforward than silence. Those who keep silent are almost always lacking in subtlety and refinement of heart. Silence is an objection. To swallow a grievance must necessarily produce a bad temper. It even upsets the stomach. All silent people are dyspeptic. You perceive that I should not like to see rudeness undervalued. It is by far the most humane form of contradiction. And, in the midst of modern effeminacy, it is one of our first virtues. If one is sufficiently rich for it, it may even be a joy to be wrong. If a god were to descend to this earth, he would have to do nothing but wrong, to take guilt, not punishment on one's shoulders, is the first proof of divinity. 6. Freedom from resentment and the understanding of the nature of resentment. Who knows how very much, after all, I am indebted to my long illness for these two things? The problem is not exactly simple. A man must have experienced both through his strength and through his weakness. If illness and weakness are to be charged with anything at all, it is with the fact that when they prevail, the very instinct of recovery, which is the instinct of defence and of war in man, becomes decayed. He knows not how to get rid of anything, how to come to terms with anything, and how to cast anything behind him. Everything wounds him. People and things draw importunately near. All experiences strike deep. Memory is a gathering wound. To be ill is a sort of resentment in itself. Against this resentment, the invalid has only one great remedy. I call it Russian fatalism. That fatalism which is free from revolt, and with which the Russian soldier, to whom a campaign proves unbearable, ultimately lays himself down in the snow. To accept nothing more, to undertake nothing more, to absorb nothing more, to cease entirely from reacting. The tremendous sagacity of this fatalism, which does not always imply merely the courage for death, but which, in the most dangerous cases, may actually constitute a self-preservative measure, amounts to a reduction of activity in the vital functions, the slackening down of which is like a sort of will to hibernate. A few steps further in this direction we find the fakir, who will sleep for weeks in a tomb, owing to the fact that one would be used up too quickly if one reacted. One no longer reacts at all. This is the principle. And nothing on earth consumes a man more quickly than the passion of resentment, mortification, morbid susceptibility, the inability to wreak revenge, the desire and thirst for revenge, the concoction of every sort of poison. This is surely the most injurious manner of reacting which could possibly be conceived by exhausted men. It involves a rapid wasting away of nervous energy, an abnormal increase of detrimental secretions, as for instance, that of bile into the stomach. To the sick man, resentment ought to be more strictly forbidden than anything else. It is his special danger. Unfortunately, however, it is also his most natural propensity. This was fully grasped by that profound psychologist, Buddha. His religion, which it would be better to call a system of hygiene, in order to avoid confounding it with a creed so wretched as Christianity, depended for its effect upon the triumph over resentment. To make the soul free therefrom was considered the first step towards recovery. Not through hostility is hostility put to flight. Through friendship does hostility end. This stands at the beginning of Buddha's teaching. This is not a precept of morality, but of psychology. Resentment born of weakness is not more deleterious to anybody than it is to the weak man himself. Conversely, in the case of that man whose nature is fundamentally a rich one, resentment is a superfluous feeling, a feeling to remain master of which is almost a proof of riches. Those of my readers who know the earnestness with which my philosophy wages war against the feelings of revenge and rancor, even to the extent of attacking the doctrine of free will, my conflict with Christianity is only a particular instance of it, will understand why I wish to focus attention upon my own personal attitude, and the certainty of my practical instincts precisely in this matter. In my moments of decadence, I forbade myself the indulgence of the above feelings, because they were harmful. As soon as my life recovered enough riches and pride, however, I regarded them again as forbidden, but this time because they were beneath me. That Russian fatalism, of which I have spoken, manifested itself in me in such a way that for years I held tenaciously to almost insufferable conditions, places, habitations, and companions, once chance had placed them on my path. It was better than changing them, than feeling that they could be changed, than revolting against them. He who stirred me from this fatalism, he who violently tried to shake me into consciousness, seemed to me then a mortal enemy. In point of fact, there was danger of death each time this was done. To regard oneself as a destiny, not to wish oneself different, this, in such circumstances, is sagacity itself. 7. War, on the other hand, is something different. At heart, I am a warrior. Attacking belongs to my instincts. To be able to be an enemy, to be an enemy, maybe these things presuppose a strong nature. In any case, all strong natures involve these things. Such natures need resistance. Consequently, they go in search of obstacles. The pathos of aggression belongs of necessity to strength as much as the feelings of revenge and of rancor belongs to weakness. Woman, for instance, is revengeful. Her weakness involves this passion, just as it involves a susceptibility in the presence of other people's suffering. The strength of the aggressor can be measured by the opposition which he needs. Every increase of growth betrays itself by seeking out of more formidable opponents or problems. For a philosopher who is combative challenges even problems to a duel. The task is not to overcome opponents in general, but only those opponents against whom one has to summon up all one's strength, one's skill, and one's swordsmanship. In fact, opponents who are one's equals. To be one's enemy's equal. This is the first condition of an honorable duel. When one despises, one cannot wage war. Where one commands, where one sees something beneath one, one ought not to wage war. My war tactics can be reduced to four principles. First, I attack only things that are triumphant. If necessary, I wait until they become triumphant. Secondly, I attack only those things against which I find no allies, against which I stand alone, against which I compromise nobody but myself. I have not yet taken one single step before the public eye which did not compromise me. That is my criterion of a proper mode of action. Thirdly, I never make personal attacks. I use a personality merely as a magnifying glass, by means of which I render a general, but elusive and scarcely noticeable evil more apparent. In this way I attacked David Strauss, or rather, the success given to a senile book by the cultured classes of Germany. By this means I caught German culture red-handed. In this way I attacked Wagner, or rather, the falsity or mongrel instincts of our culture, which confounds the super-refined with the strong, and the effete with the great. Fourthly, I attack only those things from which all personal differences are excluded, in which any such thing as a background of disagreeable experiences is lacking. On the contrary, attacking is to me a proof of goodwill, and, in certain circumstances, of gratitude. By means of it, I do honour to a thing, I distinguish a thing, whether I associate my name with that of an institution or a person. By being against or for either is all the same to me. If I wage war against Christianity, I feel justified in doing so because in that quarter I have met with no fatal experiences and difficulties. The most earnest Christians have always been kindly disposed to me. I, personally, the most essential opponent of Christianity, am far from holding the individual responsible for what is the fatality of long ages. 8. May I be allowed to hazard a suggestion concerning one last trait in my character, which in my intercourse with other men has led me into some difficulties? I am gifted with a sense of cleanliness, the keenness of which is phenomenal, so much so that I can ascertain physiologically, that is to say, smell, the proximity, nay, the innermost core, the entrails of every human soul. This sensitiveness of mine is furnished with psychological antennae, wherewith I feel and grasp every secret, the quality of concealed filth lying at the base of many a human character, which may be the inevitable outcome of base blood, and which education may have veneered, is revealed to me at the first glance. If my observation has been correct, such people, whom my sense of cleanliness rejects, also become conscious, on their part, of the cautiousness to which my loathing prompts me, and this does not make them any more fragrant. In keeping with the custom which I have long observed, pure habits and honesty towards myself are among the first conditions of my existence. I would die in unclean surroundings. I swim, bathe, and splash about, as it were, incessantly in water, in any kind of perfectly transparent and shining element. That is why my relations with my fellows try my patience to no small extent. My humanity does not consist in the fact that I can understand the feelings of my fellows, but that I can endure to understand. My humanity is a perpetual process of self-mastery. But I need solitude, that is to say, recovery, return to myself, the breathing of free, crisp, bracing air. The whole of my Zarathustra is a diathram in honour of solitude, or, if I have been understood, in honour of purity. Thank heaven, it is not in honour of pure foolery. Translator's note. This, of course, is a reference to Wagner's Parsifal. See my note on page 96 of The Will to Power, Volume 1. End translator's note. He who has an eye for colour will call him a diamond. The loathing of mankind, of the rabble, was always my greatest danger. Would you hearken to the words spoken by Zarathustra concerning deliverance from loathing? What forsooth hath come unto me? How did I deliver myself from loathing? Who hath made my eye younger? How did I soar to the height where there are no more rabble sitting about the well? Did my very loathing forge me wings and the strength to send fountains far off? Verily, to the loftiest heights did I need to fly, to find once more the spring of joyfulness. Oh, I have found it, my brethren! Up here, on the loftiest height, the spring of joyfulness gusheth forth for me. And there is a life at the well of which no rabble can drink with you. Almost too fiercely doth thou rush for me, thou spring of joyfulness, and oft times dost thou empty the pitcher again in trying to fill it. And yet I must learn to draw near thee more humbly. Far too eagerly doth my heart jump to meet thee. My heart, whereon my summer burneth, my short, hot, melancholy, overblessed summer, how my summer heart yearneth for thy coolness. Farewell, the lingering afflictions of my spring. Past is the wickedness of my snowflakes in June. Summer have I become entirely, and summer noontide. A summer in the loftiest heights, with cold springs and blessed stillness. O come, my friends, that the stillness may wax even more blessed, for this is our height and our home. Too high and steep is our dwelling for all the unclean and their appetites. Do but cast your pure eyes into the well of my joyfulness, my friends. How could it thus become muddy? It will laugh back at you with its purity. On the tree called Future do we build our nest. Eagles shall bring food in their beaks unto us lonely ones. Verily, not the food whereof the unclean might partake. They would think they ate fire, and would burn their mouths. Verily, no abodes for the unclean do we here hold in readiness. To their bodies our happiness would seem an ice cavern, and to their spirits also. And like strong winds will we live above them, neighbours to the eagles, companions of the snow, and playmates of the sun, thus do strong winds live. And like a wind shall I one day blow amidst them, and take away their soul's breath with my spirit, thus my future willeth. Verily, a strong wind is Zarathustra to all low lands, and this is his counsel to his foes and to all who spit and spew. Beware of spitting against the wind! End of Why I Am So Wise.